Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That was the voice of our mentor and inspiration, Brian Brown, and he always gives us hope for the future. Welcome to the June 29th version of the Brown Briefly. I'm your host this week, Bruce Holman, and with me in the downtown studios, not with me, I'm at home on Zoom, but in the downtown studio of Voice of Vachon is Truman O'Brien. Truman, welcome.
Good morning. Good morning.
And Lynn Kerrigan.
Hi, good morning. I just like being in the studio. It's so cool.
It's air conditioned.
Yes, that kind of cool.
And also with us this morning is Indivisible Vachon's Kevin Jones. Welcome, Kevin.
Top of the morning to y'all.
Well, of course, this week the topic of interest to everyone is 108 degree temperatures in Seattle. Did the briefings have any insights into that? And how did you stay cool?
Before we get into that, Bruce, I have one quick announcement to make, and that is to wish you a happy birthday. So I understand that today is your birthday.
Hey. Should we sing or not?
Well, I think it's pretty. You're looking pretty good for an old guy, Bruce.
Yeah, you know, hanging in there. Right?
Yeah.
Happy birthday, man.
Yeah.
Still looking at the grass from the right direction.
That's correct. That's correct. On the right side
that.
Of the grass. That's right. congratulations on one more trip around the sun. So there you go.
You have packed more into your life than most people do.
That's true.
So keep on going.
Well
man.
Done. Well done.
I intend to keep packing.
There you go. So hey, on the heat, you know, I'm originally from West Texas, and I've always said that, you know, I really like the heat. And I do, but I think it kind of pushed the limits for me a little,
you think?
A little bit this time. I didn't get a lot done, and I did have to nap a bit, both in the morning and in the afternoon, sitting in my chair, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. I haven't felt such heat since I got off an airplane once in St. Louis and walked onto the tarmac, and I thought I was going to poach immediately.
Right there.
So I'm calling this not necessarily climate change, but climate revenge.
that's probably about right.
Well, I definitely you know, recall the times that I've worked in Houston and Denver. Denver is actually a place that I've been like experienced the hottest temperatures.
Really?
Yeah. And the coldest temperatures.
Yeah.
Not on the same day, of course. Yeah, you know, speaking of climate change, it's just always surprising to me, you know, to listen to the news commentators talk about this totally amazing and unexpectedly warm weather we're having. And, you know, I mean, the reality is that it's not unexpected. It is exactly a consequence of what we're doing in terms of putting carbon into the atmosphere. And we should expect it will continue. And I think it's important that we recognize two things. One is that there is that correlation. And there's also something called the social cost of carbon. And you might, the what, the who, the social cost of what? The social cost of carbon is a cost we all pay for the privilege of allowing utilities to pollute without restriction.
Mm-hmm.
And those costs are, you might buy an air conditioner. Your cost is, I couldn't go out today. I have to stay at home. Those are real costs. The people who lost power and have to replace a refrigerator, maybe a refrigerator and a freezer full of food. Those are costs that are very real, right? And that are totally related to what's going on with climate. I just wanted to make sure that we all clearly see that, at least I did.
Draw a line between the dots. It's interesting how much we can avoid that. you know, and just stay in our lanes of what we want to believe. But I'm with you, Kevin. I think if this isn't a lesson to somebody to see Seattle at such temperatures. I had cousins in Georgia contacting me and say, how are you surviving this? And yeah, I stayed in and napped, and thank God I had bought a heat pump about 5 years ago, and it came with, you know, the inverse, the air conditioning. So I've been cool, but listening to my friends who live in little cabins and, you know, older houses say their coconut oil is liquefying, you know, their cats are unfound, you know, under the bed somewhere. It's been a trial. I like heat, but not this.
Okay. Yeah, our roadies, the ones that reach around and face east in the morning, and they're by the driveway, so they get the reflected heat and the direct radiant heat from the sun. And they're very brown now, many of the leaves. So we're helping them with hydration. But, you know, Bruce, you were thinking about how do we sleep and how do we eat? We also have a heat pump, I guess, courtesy of my burning up a propane furnace a decade or more ago.
Exactly.
And ended up with an upgrade to a heat pump. So thankfully that keeps us cool at night. Mm-hmm. But Susie and I sat down and she said, you know, we need a menu plan here for the hot days. So we cooked up a bunch of, you know, chicken salad and potato salad.
Exactly.
And other types of things. You just don't, and they're all in the fridge.
Yep.
Hope the power stays on, right? And so we didn't even really have to turn on the stove. So that was nice.
Yeah, we did the same thing.
Yeah, me too.
You know, I was living in West Texas until I was 11 years old, which you guys already know. And so I always say, boy, I really like the heat. And I think I've said this, but this was even more than that. But I have to tell you, the night that I arrived in Saigon in 1966, that was the real eye-opener, because not only was it probably in the 80s or 90s, but the humidity was around 80%.
Exactly.
And it's like it's like walking into a wall. I mean, it is the most amazing thing ever. And thank goodness that our humidity was not real high during this time.
So in West Texas, where you were at, I take it was fairly arid?
Very dry. Very, very dry.
Yeah. I worked in, like I mentioned, I worked in Houston.
Oh,
I had the good fortune to work at Clear Lake, which is where the International Space Station project was going on.
Wow.
With the Russians and all other things. It was a fascinating thing. But yeah, I recall very clearly walking out the hotel room door on the way to work in January.
Yeah.
And it was a standard, you know, with a jacket and a tie. We had just been awarded the contract to integrate, take over from McDonnell Douglas. So you had to, like, you know, dress properly. But man, it was just like you say, Truman, walking into that wall of humidity.
Yeah.
And I called Susie and I say, you know, I think Houston is like rust and humidity. That's my experience so far.
That's right.
And I will say the one good thing is that I learned to sleep without covers. I slept for a whole year on top of the sheet. You know, well, I did have a mosquito net over me, but so I missed that yesterday and the day before. But I was able to just, you know, pull the covers back, get on the sheet, and go right to sleep. I slept like a baby both nights. So amazing. But I guess it was all that 1 year of training that did it for me.
Nice.
Good. So, Lynn, any words of advice from Georgia Peach about how to survive?
You know, I remember being a kid, and this is pre-air conditioning and not to mention heat pumps and all that, but I remember having to turn the lights off, take off all my clothes, get on top of the bed with a bowl of ice and a fan next to us.
Yeah.
And that's how we survived, you know, terrible heat and humidity in Atlanta a long time ago. And for me, I just try to conserve my energy a little bit. I found like I just don't have very much get up and go in the hot weather. So I've just been doing kind of minor things around the house and getting up really early to water my plants and then staying up really late to do my cooking. You know, I was doing any cooking that I needed to do. I did a big refrigerator transfer to a big pot of soup, which I somehow tend to like. in the summer. They say it kind of helps even out your temperature. Mm. So I cooked up a giant batch of soup last night, I think at 9:30 or 10, which was the only time I felt like I could approach my stove.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, that's why tea became the drink of preference of the British in India. I mean, why drink hot tea in the middle of a hot day? Well, it makes you sweat more, and sweat evaporates, it cools you off. It's kind of counterintuitive, but it does work.
Yeah.
You know, a contrast to the sluggishness that we're all describing, yesterday afternoon I made the weekly run to town for picking up groceries. And in our neighborhood, a few neighbors subscribe to the trash pickup service, right? And so the trash truck was ahead of me as I was leaving the driveway. And the guy who was solo doing on his own, who was operating that rig, would jump out of the cab, run out to the trash cans, pick them up, throw the trash into the back of the truck, put the can back, run into the cab and drive off, and literally did that every stop along the way all day long, 3 in the afternoon, 100 degree temperature. And I thought, okay, this is a fit person. I was pretty amazed.
And he was under 30 probably.
I wasn't able to check, wow, it's something that I wasn't really able to replicate, that's for sure.
That's for sure. Well, two things going on uptown Vashon that are interested to hear what the Brieflys think. We have a person with mental health issues who have been wandering downtown Vashon, ranting and raving, walking down the middle of the street. Has broken windows in a number of stores. And so what do the Brieflys think? How does the community respond to an issue like this?
Wow, that's such a layered question, Bruce. You know, there's so many issues in there. You know, what do we do to keep safe? What do we do to help people who are suffering and out of control? And, you know, how do we make our community both inclusive and safe is a, you know, it's a big question. I don't know how even to begin to answer it in a short form. You know, I think we have to keep ourselves safe from street violence of any kind. And yet there's symptoms, you know, that are increasing here as everywhere, of mental illness and violent tendencies that, you know, seem to have been normalized from a national level all the way down to our little island that I think we like to believe is separate and apart from, you know, the national norms, and it's not.
I can say, Bruce, that it was a couple of years ago now, definitely pre-COVID, where I was at Thriftway, and there was a person there who was clearly having trouble, not necessarily a ranting and raving type of description that you provided, but, and I don't recall actually the details. I did talk with this person, tried to understand the issues and concerns that they had. Fortunately, a few others gathered, including somebody who had the kind of background and training that Lynn has, you know, in terms of counseling. And it was determined that this is a person who is living in a, you know, a sort of communal living arrangement made available to folks who otherwise wouldn't have a housing opportunity. Somebody who had gathered and knew that group was there and knew that they had some folks watching out for them, one of the local churches in Vashon. And they were able to connect this person back into that community. What happened after that, I do not know. And whether the situation you're describing is now a new normal, or if it's it's an incident that was heightened maybe by the heat that we have, and that, of course, as it retreats, may improve and reduce the stress on people. But I guess I'd just say I'm fortunate that we know there's people in our community who are dedicated to serving and helping, and it's probably helpful for us to understand who they are and how to connect folks with them when we see this, when we observe this.
Truman, any thoughts?
Well, yes, I appreciate what you're saying. And, you know, I think we're always balancing, you know, what is truly, you know, illegal behavior and, you know, trying to keep all of us safe from violence. You know, that's the question we're having now on a national level about policing and, you know, how do we maintain protection and safety of all citizens, including people who are homeless and mentally ill, and on the other hand, still drawing boundaries about what is tolerable societal behavior. And I think both are true, that they're not in conflict as much as they are in terms of the national discussion on how do we do both of them well. I don't think that we do it well out here, frankly, because we don't have public health services. We don't have a big mental health center. You know, we have small agencies who do what they can, and mostly for families and kids, and, you know, helping to try to integrate the Latino, Latinx communities into our child and family services and all of that. I really respect all of that. But I think that we pretend we're a bedroom community out here of wealthy white people without such problems. That's kind of a myth that we have out here. And I agree with you that heat exacerbates violence. I've seen that many times, you know, in the Harborview ER. The full moon exacerbates weirdness. It just does. And, you know, we've had the COVID and we've had, you know, lots of isolation and non-reaching out to each other around, you know, better services or even just better understanding and communication with people who are struggling. And so I think it is, you know, kind of the worst of all worlds. I know that's not true. It could always get worse, can't it? I just think that we're in a kind of a crisis point here, where a lot of things are coming into stark relief about how we balance a society kind of for the good of all. You know, there are no easy answers to this.
Hey, Bruce, one of the things that you talked about broken windows, and do you want to go into a little more? Is there any rationale, do you think, behind that? Is it one incident or multiple incidences? I'm curious what you've heard.
Multiple.
No, I'm just going to say there's multiple. I mean, broke all over this out of the bank, you know, Island Queen, across the street at going blank, Giraffe, you know. Yeah. So
I did not know any of this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
See, I'm in my little bubble.
Yeah. And I, of course, I really want to smack down on that kind of stuff. I have a real short fuse when it comes to that kind of thing. I don't know what the word is, but
social unrest, yeah, and I'm the protests that
I'm not big on it
bleed into violence.
Exactly.
It seems like there's sort of two separate things going on. One, there's this one individual who clearly has mental health issues, who's been a disturbance in the Vashon Town area for going on a month plus now, was living out of a car down by the fire station for a while, until that got towed. And, you know, and certainly a number of people in the community know of this individual, have worked with that individual, those kind of things. So that's one issue. And that's, and there's been multiple sort of incidences over the past month. And they seem to be escalating. The second issue is a concrete bucket thrown through the window of Island Bloom just last week at the statue, at the painting of one of the Black Lives Matter portraits. And that's another set of violent incidences in terms of attacking those Black Lives Matter portraits that are around the island. And that seems to be a separate kind of thing than the mental health kind of thing, clearly motivated by a form of racism. So my question really is how do you separate those two? How do you deal with those two kinds of things? One's clearly a mental health issue in a system that's broken. The other is sort of overt racism
Yeah, totally.
And violent attacks on representatives of Black Lives Matter, regardless of how you feel about Black Lives Matter, what's the proper response to violence, violent racism in an island community. So there's sort of two things to talk about here. Yeah, true.
Well, in terms of the violence, I treat those the same. If you do the crime, you're going to have to do the time, period. I don't care what the rationale is, whether you're mentally deficient or racist or what. Those I keep in the same category. Absolutely.
And I agree with you, Truman.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the hate crime, cuts into a fundamental right of a group of people being, disrespected and not allowed to be who they are for no other reason than somebody doesn't like it. And I think that is egregious in a different level than sort of damaging property for, vandalism and thrills or whatever. We've had a lot of minor vandalism on Vashon over the years. But I just want to say I really agree that some of the laws that cover both of these types of incidents should be relied on. That's a hate crime, in my opinion, and it needs to be intercepted and punished.
One of the other things that, I've heard from some of my more conservative friends is that here on Vashon, the whole Black Lives Matter thing is kind of a moot point. It's like, what do we have, two or three black people that live on the island? And we're the most open and giving, a community ever. And it's kind of like, well, why are we doing all of this here? That's what I've heard from some folks. So I understand that too, but that still doesn't mean you go and, and vandalize stuff. That's beyond the pale for me.
Kevin. I supported a candidate running for state legislature, Joyce Stanford. She was running in the 26th, which is across Colville's Passage from us. And somebody here on Vashon had some of the stanchions that the signs, yard signs go on, and offered them to her campaign. And she said, I'd love to come over to Vashon and pick them up. And I was away when she was here, but I talked to her that following week, and she said, I thoroughly enjoyed my visit on Vashon. It's a place that I went and I didn't get the look of like, what are you doing here and why are you here?
Yeah, exactly.
So yes, Truman, I agree. Right. There is a lot to be said for that. Lynn, you mentioned earlier the myth of Vashon as this sort of bedroom community that doesn't have these problems. And while predominantly, I think a lot of people on Vashon are very aware and understand the history of race relationships in the United States, they also understand that it's a national narrative. And to excuse yourself from the national narrative is to basically passively condone what is happening across the country regarding oppression and suppression and violence towards people of color. Heather McGee, in her book, The Sum of Us, starts out by talking about a zero-sum mentality, that if you end up with your life being better, my life has got to be worse as a consequence of it. And if we can look at the world through a view of plenty, and not everything is, of course, but if we can do that and realize that we can all gain together, I think that, that might help people feel that they don't have to be threatened by the notion of let's support communities of color who have been oppressed for so long. And so I fear that maybe the concrete bucket thrown through the window at Blooms, maybe somebody who's feeling feeling oppressed, that some other group's going to get ahead of them. And they subscribe to, and perhaps they subscribe to that zero sum mentality. I would say call Blooms and thank them for expressing their support to a multiracial coalition, a multiracial country. Their number is 206-607-8885. And the Vashon Center for the Arts has been vandalized as well. So maybe they need to hear from the community that, you know, we support what they're doing and to be persistent because it's important.
I think that's a great paradigm for us to think about, Kevin, and the other kind of broader paradigm I'd introduce as well that kind of goes along with that is the whole question of Vashon. You know, Vashon is a very privileged and a very white privileged island. And I think that it's harder to see the national narrative sometimes if you're swimming in a sea of one particular culture. And I think there are issues around the sharing of power, which is what the Black Lives Matter movement is asking for. They're saying they don't want it. They don't want to be oppressed. They don't want to be treated different than in the eyes of the law and the courts and, you know, the police and all that. They want a share of the good fortune that, you know, whites have enjoyed for a long time. Not that all whites have, you know, had their fortunes appreciate as much as others. But I think what I'm trying to say is that, excuse me, that the idea of white privilege, you know, although it's controversial and supposedly not to be taught anymore from Donald Trump's administration, you know, critical race theory is what that kind of comes out of, looking at not just individual aggressions on each other, micro or macro, but it looked at the systems that privilege or that support one culture or one race over another. And to, you know, when I said we're a sleepy bedroom community and that's our myth, I mean, that is almost the definition of kind of white privileged society. We have a moat between us and a lot of the urban problems that are so clear and constant, you know, over in Seattle or LA or New York or whatever. And so we can easily maintain the sense that we're better or we're different or we're apart from all of that. And I just think this is coming home to us that we are not separate than the national narrative and the questions that are being raised about privilege and sharing and how much violence can and should be tolerated in that basically kind of a civil war, you know, that we're kind of undergoing right now. And I don't mean that as a civil war from whites and blacks. I am meaning that I think whites are having a civil war. I've been reading some of the definitions and kind of thinking that is in the New Yorker and all that, where they're really talking about, you know, whites have yet to come to grips with how we're going to manage these great divisions of power and wealth and history and all of that. It's a great opportunity for us to really relook at our history and our future. And I'm hoping that it won't be drowned in violence and hate, but that we'll get more conscious of some of the factors involved in some of this stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's a challenge. You know, it's difficult for, I mean, how should I put it? Position and privilege are badges sometimes that people wear, and they're fearful that they're taken away from them. Right? It's easy to think about, well, what if some other group is in charge? What becomes of me then? So, but again, that's a way of looking at things which doesn't allow for the very real possibility that what happens when we approach that multicultural, multiracial equity community that we all prosper because we're bringing together and allowing more space for better ideas, right? You know, McGee goes on in her book to talk about the communities that have filled in their public swimming pools and so everybody in the community, right, would benefit from having a public swimming pool in the summertime. But these groups decided to fill them in. And her theory is that many in the community were convinced that that would elevate the privilege of another group of people who are not like you. And that would basically erode your privilege. So we can't allow these benefits to be experienced by these other groups, because then you lose your status as a consequence. So, and apparently it's very pervasive and very effective messaging and very subliminal. Her book attempts to expose those thoughts, which maybe is a step in the direction that, that we could all benefit from going.
I have kind of one more thing to say to kind of add to this conversation, which is something I read this last week, which I knew, but I hadn't thought of it consciously. And I think, Kevin, what you're talking about where, you know, we're actually being asked to look at things differently now due to a number of issues. But, you know, we talk about this is an experiment in democracy and that we've had, what, 200, 300 years of American democracy. And I've thrown around, I know myself, the term a multiracial democracy, you know, that it is a great experiment as we get into the idea of a multiracial democracy. And I read that we've really only had that since 1965 and the Civil Rights Act of 1965, that before all this was suppressed by slavery and then Reconstruction, that got sort of turned into Jim Crow. The era in the South that I grew up in, where it was the separate but equal. And the equal wasn't very equal either. So I guess what I'm saying is that we're not long into this conversation that we're having and the figuring out of how we're going to change the way we include a lot of people. I guess for younger people, 1965 was a long time ago. For me, I was just a sophomore in college. So, you know, I grew up under a very different era than we're trying to create now, or some people are trying to create with, you know, certainly the Black Lives Matter folks are trying to create. And I'm glad for it, because when we bury conflicts like this, it's going to seep out in one way or another, some kind of behavior that somebody is going to say, no, stop it, you know, no more. And I think that's a very different kind of issue from people who are truly mentally ill and are not really in control of their faculties. I'm not saying they should be excused of violent crime. I'm just saying it's a different set of actions and thoughts that have to go into, you know, how do we treat both of these?
So picking up from this and moving on, Derek Chauvin was sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison for the murder of George Floyd. Significant? Was it just, unjust? Too long a sentence, too short a sentence? What do the briefleys think?
Well, one of the things that I was relieved to see was that I thought that the length of the sentence was satisfying to enough people that it would suppress any outward protest or whatever from either side. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so long that you know, conservatives would be up in arms because it, you know, well, he was being punished for just doing his job. And it was long enough that the Black Lives Matter folks would say, okay, that was a fair, you know. So anyway, I thought it was well thought out. If you want to know the actual amount of time,
Kevin,
I was kind of had the same thoughts, Truman, and maybe just a slightly different way that I was thinking about it was that, you know, there have been so many of these cases. Well, let me put it this way. There have been few cases where law enforcement has been held to account in the courts, but the predominant number of those cases results in some communities being very unsatisfied with the outcome of the sentencing, right? So it was like, we've gotten to a place now where it looks like the justice system is moving towards the point where we as a society, in all of our diversity and the way we think about this, is it's centering better, right, with how we as a community feel justice should be dispensed. And that's what a democracy is, right? It's like, it's not some one person's decision. It's us collectively helping to navigate the system to the point where we see equity. And I think this is one instance where we've seen more equity than we certainly have in the past. The Floyd family, of course, said, you know, and everybody understands this, they've had a tremendous loss. There's nothing that's going to change that. This sentence, it could have been a, you know, lifetime sentence. It wouldn't change that. I do think it was just. I also thought the news media that I listened to encouraged people to read the judge's decision and see, as Truman, you mentioned, that it was well thought out and logical.
Yeah.
And I think that was a bit to also allay an immediate response of it's not okay and I need to go protest.
Exactly.
And I do think it's important that we, you know, take a look at where these trends are going. Are they heading in the direction we think is appropriate, and support them if we do? And of course, we have elected officials to talk to if they're not.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I was very relieved personally at that sentence. I thought that it was, as you said, Truman, a good, serious answer to that crime that we all watched on TV, and did not let somebody in power off the hook. It was a beginning to me of accountability for police, who some police seem to feel like they've had a license to kill, and certainly you know, have been giving very different responses to people who are Black and people of color than they do of whites. It's very well documented. And I heard, I think it was Lloyd Austin. Isn't he the attorney general, the new attorney general for Biden?
No.
Or is he's the defense person.
Yeah.
And no, it wasn't him, and it wasn't Blinken. So I can't remember who it was. I'm so sorry. But it was on National Public Radio, where it was an African-American of high office, who said that he also was grateful to see accountability beginning to happen in our systems, and yet said he is watching the movements around better policing and less biased policing with great interest, and is saying that, you know, we still have a lot of things to consider around what is called qualified immunity, you know, where basically police are given the benefit of a doubt when they have an incident like that and are seen as having such a tough job to hoe that I guess things happen. And so the law has been on the side of the policeman for a long time. And he would like to see that addressed. And he would like to see policemen who have been bad apples, you know, bad actors, not be able to just transfer from department to department. He wants to see a national kind of database around these issues so that people are tracked if they have committed kind of crimes in their office. So, you know, I just think it was a good effort and a good beginning to better accountability for fairer treatment of Blacks in, you know, by those in authority.
Kevin? It's you also, Bruce, talked about, you know, the Justice Department, justice system, and the implications on the justice system, which I, of course, I include policing as part of sort of law enforcement in general. And so I guess I'm going to be interested to hear if there's any studies done, and I hope that there are, of the rationale of police officers leaving the profession and the new challenges we're hearing about staffing police forces. And I can envision there's maybe a couple of rationales for that, right? One is that it's the job is clearly difficult, as Lynn says, and I think these examples are exemplar of the challenges that police face. And it could it be that folks are saying, you know, I thought that sounded like a good job, and maybe now I'm thinking maybe it's not so much. Or there's an alternative to where if the freedom to oppress and use violence against people who are criminals is removed from the toolbox, maybe some folks who are operating in the force are saying, yeah, that's maybe not that I was looking for the ability to do that. Or they feel that maybe it's just part of their public safety, their personal safety. So I'm just really curious, you know, what are the thoughts of folks who are now leaving the force or those who are declining to now apply? And I have no idea what it is, but I can, you know, imaginations run wild. So maybe there's some other example, other reasons.
I can see that maybe there are some folks who just feel like they're not getting the community support that they expected, you know, or the support of their community council or, you know, city council or whatever it is. So they're saying, well, you don't support me, then the heck with you. I'm out of here, that kind of thing. I don't know.
Point well made. Totally agree, Truman. That's got to be a huge part of it.
Yeah.
And I guess I wonder about whether the duty to protect and serve, you know, which is one definition of policing, can be managed to be affected in that way when the police in the last, I don't know, what, 20, 30 years have been militarized. Mm-hmm. You know, that I think has really changed the nature of policing when everything is met in riot gear, you know, with tactical weapons and, you know, great force. There's something wrong with the police not being a part of the community and listening to people and seeing everyone as valid to be served and protected. Not that you don't stop crime, but that, you know, you wield your power. And it's too great a power, in my opinion, right now. It's huge power, which, you know, can bring you astray. But I think it's very hard to police as a part of the community if you see yourself as a military body with enemies.
Yeah, one of the things I was going to say is like the whole business of bobbies, you know, and being unarmed and community policing, a totally different view.
Exactly.
You know, a way different thing. Hey, guys, we only have about 3 minutes left here. I need to put out a plug, and I wanted to be sure you guys heard it, and that is that this coming Thursday, that's day after tomorrow, 7 o'clock, live will be Penny Tellequah and Ms. Olson Incident. It's a live play being done on the radio here at KVSH. I've got the honor of being able to engineer for it, and we had a rehearsal last night, and I'm telling you, it is terrific. I want to just put word out for you guys to tell your friends, tune in to KVSH on Thursday at 7 p.m., it's going to be a live production, so, you know, warts and all, you'll hear probably a few errors, but it is great.
Can you say one more thing about the plot or what happened, what this incident's about?
Well, it's written by a local author, in fact, someone who was in my daughter's class. Brilliant play, and it's about Macaw Island. Funny that it should be an island and that it should have a moat around it as we do, and it has to do with a hydroplane race, and so there is that connection. But it's very much Vashon Island, but with different names included. And anyway, it is wonderful. You're going to love it. The talent is just beyond measure. I can't tell you how great these folks are. So anyway, that's my plug for the day. I want everybody to be sure and tune in on Thursday.
Thank you, Chairman. Yeah. We've only got about a minute left, and today is sort of the last day of mask restrictions and COVID restrictions in Washington State. Apparently tomorrow, all that goes away. How are the Briefleys reacting to that? Are you going to change your behavior? Are you going to do what you continue to do? Any thoughts?
Well,
I'll just applaud.
Yeah, hallelujah, yeah. Brother. You know? You know, here in the studio, we have been so darn careful from day one. We wipe down everything. We have the little booties on the mics. We, you know, we clean everything thoroughly. And you know, I think that's probably not a bad thing for the flu season and cold season. So, I suspect that'll continue here at the station. Other than that, I'm not going to wear it when I go to the transfer station anymore, but probably Thriftway. Yeah. You know, because I'm sure they will continue, but at the pharmacy, those kinds of things. But
yeah, I'm grateful for the lifting of the restrictions, but I'm also still cautious enough to want to, in enclosed crowds, you know, probably wear a mask for a while. I don't know why, or I don't know for how long, but I'm easing myself out of the restrictions because it feels weird not to.